been on a low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine. I've been on the low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Project Mayday. These are your hosts, G and Bree. And today we have Nancy Carbone. She is the founder of an organization called Friends of Firefighters, which pretty much gives support to active and retired New York City firefighters and their families. And she'll dive into all of that and the details of why she did it and what drove her to keep it going, you know, 20 plus years, because it did start within days of 9/11. So, Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
So, Nancy, first, 9/11 happens, and can you tell us how this foundation, this not-for-profit organization started?
Initially, it was not. I didn't set out to start an organization. Initially, everyone, I think, in New York wanted to help in some way. We had heard reports within hours that we may have lost up to 500 or more firefighters, and that resonated with me as my someone on my mom's family, an uncle died line of duty. So for me to see the firefighters in that kind of distress after a lifetime of understanding that they are the heroes that come in and save us, I wanted to help. But the real driving factor was that five of my friends are firefighters, and on the day of 9/11 and a few days after, I didn't know if they survived. I found out that they did, but until I found out, I went to local firehouses to see how I could help.
Yeah, so, you know, that day, 9/11, for me, it was very different than for Bree, and obviously for you, you know, us being on the West Coast, just staring at a television screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in fifth grade, and so I didn't really grasp the entire, you know, totality of the situation. And, you know, Bree, she can speak on to her, you know, experience. However, you know, for you, you had people there, mm-hmm. and you had people that might be in the building. So break down that experience and that dialogue that you had with yourself.
I don't have that dialogue with myself. I actually don't often think about that day, because I always think of the people who lost so much. And for me, my experience was different from theirs. I lived in Brooklyn at the time, just across the water from the towers. And I was actually sleeping a little late because I had driven down from my son's college the night before. And I heard what I thought was something landing on our roof. I saw an airplane drop something on our roof. And I told my husband, go up on the roof and see if you can see anything, you know, because I hear something really loud. The building shook. And then my sister-in-law called me from Florida and said, turn on your TV. And I said, what's going on? And she said, planes have hit the World Trade Center. When she said planes, everyone knew. I mean, the first one, nobody really knew it was an attack. The second one, you know it's an attack. And my first thought was to get my daughter out of school. Mm-hmm. My husband and I ran to her school to get her out. She's hearing impaired, and she felt the vibrations. Mm. By the time we got to her school, one of the towers had fallen. So it was literally snowing, black ash everywhere. And my recollection at that time was keeping my daughter safe, calming her, bringing her away from the school, seeing friends, and we were trying to get news. When the buildings came down, that's where the television antenna was on the top of one of the towers. So we couldn't get reception. So we went to a friend's house that had cable. My big regret is that my daughter, who was 15 at the time, just watched it over and over. And that was, in hindsight, not the best thing to do. We did pull away, but, you know, we were watching people that we were familiar with, and you know, I wasn't that familiar with the fire department at that time, but my son's grade school was there. We recognized his teacher, you know, so things like that were too familiar. But the first day really was hunkering down and making calls and seeing if I could find where my friends were that day.
Yeah. So, you know, this organization that you have, Friends of Firefighters, it was started within days. So was there were you already planning on starting this and this kind of like, okay, we got to start this now? Or I just don't understand how you create a nonprofit that's lasted 20 mm-hmm. years with just the flip of a switch. Yeah. Like, so what, so how did that come about?
So I think the most honest answer is I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So what I was doing, like everyone else, I went to the firehouse to say, how can I help? Many people did that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that it was morphing into a nonprofit. What I was doing was I was helping friends. And I built relationships, not with that long-term thought that, oh, this could be a nonprofit. The nonprofit started those first days when I went to a local firehouse and one of the firefighters there who's now retired, John Sorrentino, he said, we need three things right now. We need bunting for the firehouse because we lost eight guys and we know they're dead, which was amazing because no one knew their people were dead, but he felt strongly that they were, and they were. The second thing he wanted was a bugler for their funeral. And this is like the second or third day.
Yeah.
And then the last thing he said stunned me. He said, we're going to need counselors. So that to me at the time stunned me. And now it actually stuns me even more because as close as I am now, counseling was really not something that firefighters requested.
Yeah.
At the time, counseling was, I don't want to say looked down on, but you know, they're very, very strong and they don't want to think of anyone being a weak link. And I think at the time the perception was that there's someone in counseling, then they may not be able to be counted on in a bad job, a fire or something. So I was really surprised by that request, but I was also humbled by it. And I took it very seriously that that's a responsibility that if I was going to bring in counselors, by the way, I am not one. I'm a mom. So I'm thinking, if I'm going to bring somebody in and they trust me, they've got to be the right people.
Yeah.
So the bunting I got, the bugler I found at a funeral. And then it wasn't until March that I was able to find counselors. But that's how it started. It started organically. And then I helped one house. And then I had to go to the other house because that's where my friend, who's a brother to me, Kevin Dermody, he was at Engine 82 up in the Bronx. He was the lieutenant. And so now I'm in Brooklyn and I'm in the Bronx. And then I heard Hazmat and Squad, Squad 288 and Hazmat lost 19 members. So I went over to that house and then just starting to distribute the things that they needed at the time, socks, boots, just things they asked for. I started helping write eulogies with some of the members, just background things. None of it was alone. Everybody helped each other. So they just threw me tasks and I did them. So I don't want it to be like I came in and took over. I did not. Mm-hmm. I took the orders and went and did what was decided for me. I think what really became a turning point was around Christmas time 01 when John asked me if I would open up a counseling place away from the firehouse, away from the fire department, so that there was no track of it on their records.
Mm.
And that was the turning point.
Mm.
So again, it was March where I partnered. To say that, but it's kind of funny because I was just a woman driving around in a car. Honestly, I was going and a car that needed to be fixed at every stop. So it was interesting that it grew to how it did. But at the time, what I did was I partnered with Safe Horizon, and they needed to infiltrate, for lack of a better word, the fire culture because they weren't having any traction at all.
Yeah.
Not too surprisingly. So they, firefighters came from the site, which became Ground Zero. In the beginning, they called it the pile for obvious reasons. And then it was halfway to being called the pit. So they were building there and then coming over to this empty storefront. It was a plastic flower shop that my friend Elizabeth O'Connell owned. And she said, I'll give you a year's free rent, just go in and fix it up. The firefighters came from the site to fix it up. To me, that validated the need.
Mm-hmm.
So we went forward with that.
You know, that's so interesting that you said that you were really surprised that they initially asked for counseling, right? Because of course it's that culture, and that's what Project Mayday is about, is exposing, you know, the weakest link in the chain, which is not asking for help, right? So that stigma of we are superhuman, which no one is. But in that same time, 9/11, this catastrophic event, in 20 years of your nonprofit, how have you seen a pivot, a change in requesting mental health help?
Well, I think what I've observed, there are several things that I've observed. One is the original firefighters that were there and were serving the job at that time and serving the city. They came to realize that the weakest link was the firefighter who wouldn't ask for help, mm-hmm. not the one who did.
Right.
Just through experiences in the firehouses and the ones that were having difficulty. And we actually had a couple of instances where a fire truck would drop a guy off and wait outside. So just go inside, just go in and get help. And that happened a couple of times. And again, I want to stress that I am not the counselor.
Right.
So we had some magical counselors and still do. Our counselors are great. But the other thing is the job got younger. A lot of the firefighters retired. Unfortunately, a lot of them passed away from 9/11 cancer. And now the younger ones are not as resistant to mental health as the cowboys were.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different now. The perception is different. But yet, I do think there still is some hesitation when it comes to going to their job for counseling. The fire department of New York City has an excellent counseling program. You cannot take away people's perception. If they perceive it to be impacting their career in a negative way, they will not go. Mm-hmm. So yes, many do go. So I want to state that it's an excellent program. But the ones that don't go, they need to know that there's another option, and that's where we come in.
Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are really, you know, as far as New York goes, and you're saying, you know, as far as, you know, asking for help and all that is changing. Now we're starting to see that change on the West Coast, where we are just now kind of experiencing that change that mm-hmm. you saw maybe 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to see that now here, which is amazing. But we're so far behind, you know, New York. And it's just interesting to me and just blows my mind how long it takes.
Yes.
To get to everybody. And it's just mind-blowing.
It does take a long time. And when you say get to everybody, please don't mistake that I think I got to everybody. That's not it. This is culture. This is society. This is so many other things that I have nothing to do with. I'm observing that. But I think we have to ask ourselves, how many suicides does it take?
Yeah.
Because that's really the bottom line, right? Mm-hmm. Does a firefighter, a first responder, police officer, EMS, do they have to pull the trigger? Or, you know, for others to understand that this isn't something that's just a bad Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is there's a cumulative effect to seeing trauma repeatedly. They have families that they go home to. The families get secondary trauma. This PTSD is real. And so I think for us, a pivotal point as far as our credibility within the department, within the members, not the department. The department's a different story. We can address that separately. But for the members was when Hurricane Sandy hit.
Mm-hmm.
When Sandy hit, we were out in the fields almost immediately, and we were gutting the houses, pumping them out, working with different firefighters. Philly Pillay is one of the guys who set up out in the Rockaways. And the idea was to get the members back on their feet. So if you can help one firefighter, that firefighter is going to turn around and help at least 10 more people.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, let's get them going. So we had over 700 active firefighters and over 1,200 retirees, several of them sick, that either lost their homes completely, where their homes were literally upside down. And I don't mean like when we say we have company coming over, my house is upside down. I mean the roof is on the bottom and the cellar is on the top. And otherwise, those, obviously, we had to find them lodging and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was firefighters from around the world started to come and stay at our firehouse in Brooklyn. We're in an old firehouse now and have been since late in 2009. And in doing that, and we took on 4 feet of water ourselves. So firefighters came, cleaned it out, deconned. We put in 14 bunk beds and then started having firefighters come from all over the world to go out. We deployed them into the different fields and they worked all day. And I won't say who, but some of them drank all night and I was astounded that they could get up the next day, but they didn't even sleep for a whole week. So I'm blown away by them. But it was an act of love. It's a tribe. And so when the things that happened, like Hurricane Katrina, you know, FDNY went down there, many fire departments did, but FDNY and New Orleans built a tight bond after that. Biloxi, Mississippi, all the different states there suffered so terribly. And it's these disasters where the tribe just all comes together.
Yeah.
They're not even necessarily asked to come. They go. They just go. They'll take their vacation time. They'll go and they'll help each other. So it was reciprocated when 9/11 happened. It was reciprocated when Hurricane Sandy happened.
You know, something I do want to touch on too is you've described the counselors. They're incredible. And one of the things that I find very interesting and motivating with Friends of Firefighters is that you vet these counselors or therapists. Can you explain first why you do that and second why that's important?
Oh my goodness, I can explain both reasons. The first thing is I got to witness in the firehouses early on people that were in over their heads in the kitchen. Young counselors that really did mean well. Everyone did mean well, so I don't want to ridicule anyone because it was a very tough time. But you're in over your head if you walk in with a clipboard and say, how do you feel today? And they're filthy from ground zero. Well, we laugh, but that's a reality that I saw several times. So my initial thought is I want to be able to look at the person that we're interviewing, which, by the way, Stephanie Cherry is our clinical supervisor. She's the one that chooses. And then, you know, when she's happy, she brings the one. I say, okay, let's sit down. Is it somebody I want to sit with? It really is very important that if I don't want to sit with this person, trust me, the firefighters aren't going to want to sit with this person. And they may be very, very good, but they just may not have that. Like, I was born into a very large family, right? Irish Catholic family is noise all the time. It's chaotic. So I'm at home with the firefighters. But there are people that's very foreign. If there's too many people talking, they bristle. You know, that's not going to fly for this. In the beginning, you couldn't count that a firefighter would come back for a second visit. So the idea of having firefighters come consistently was absolutely unheard of. Yet our counselors get them, they come back. They don't miss appointments unless they have to do, you know, overtime or something. So that was a big part of it. The other part is, are they willing to learn about the firefighter culture? And I think when I do want to sit with them, and they are people I would actually love to get to know and I feel comfortable with, these are the people that want to know the culture. We haven't had somebody say, no, it's my way or the highway, because it would be the highway. So I think that that's the most important part. Are they willing to learn and step outside of their comfort zone? You're not there to correct them on their political correctness. You're not there to tell them, you know, that they can't use certain language. Mm-hmm. You're a guest in their home. Really, that's the way to look at it. You're a guest in their home. You have a bag of tools that they need. Are you going to be open to the fact that they may ask for them in ways that are a little non-PC, or not even know why they're there, but just be so frustrated, and it does bleed out in different ways? Be open to the way people present. And that's what our counselors do. The counselors we have are sterling. They're really excellent. So I'm thrilled.
The subject of political correctness. I actually did a ride along with Station 11, and yes.
We don't name houses, by the way. I mean, I name them when I talk about heroic deeds, but I don't name them when I talk about what they've done.
Am I snitching right now?
No, I think they really helped you.
No, House 11 was amazing. I was just more talking about the political correctness of how they speak to just amongst each other and how they interact on calls. It's very, very different on the West Coast as far as how we show up on calls and how we interact with ourselves in the fire station, you know, and whatnot. It, when I, cause that was the first exposure that I got in first responders was my ride along at, you know, House 11. And then I came and started doing my thing here. And I'm just like, wow, there is a vast difference between running a call in New York and running a call in, you know, San Francisco. Like it's very, very different.
I've been to several firehouses throughout the country and actually overseas. And it's funny because I've been in firehouses where I don't speak the language at all. And they're the same characters I left back. I mean, you can name them.
What are those characters? Give us some characters.
Give you characters? Oh, do I have to?
Yes.
You know, there's always going to be the funny guy, right? The senior, the guy that's so funny is untouchable, right? Then you get the guy that's a little sensitive, you know, gets angry maybe. Yeah, but the jokes roll. They roll with these jokes. So the way I look at it is if you're going to critique behavior, you're not only not going to help them, you're damaging a situation. Mm-hmm. You need to step outside of a school marm. But, you know, we're not changing a culture. We're offering tools. When you step outside of that and you think that you're going to change a culture, you don't belong there. You really don't. And I think it's presumptuous to think that that's something that is even within our purview. It's not. We're there to help. We're not there to judge. And that's really important. Anyone who's in a position to help and they use it as an opportunity to judge, I would fire them in a heartbeat.
All right. So how can other departments use the template of Friends of Firefighters to create their own inclusive culture that you have been so successful in really promoting?
Well, I would change that question just a little bit, if I may. The departments don't. The department can't. It has to come from either the unions or the members or, you know, someone maybe outside but closely affiliated. Look, this all started because of a disaster, a massive disaster, massive murder. And the doors were open. And I didn't say, oh, it's an opportunity, you know, to get in there. It sort of just, it developed out of the need that was expressed, right? And it wasn't like I did it alone. It's really important to know that there were hundreds and at this point, thousands of people that have contributed to make it the organization it is today. So I think what's really important is to look at what are the needs of your department, right? Who is trusted amongst the members? How can you, you know, I don't know whether there are unions that would want to raise the money to have a counselor. We have over 11,000 members, not even close to talking about retirees, because that and their family members just put it into, you know, ridiculous numbers, which is great. And I love it when there's so many that are retired, but they're healthy and living well. So, but I think it has to come from the membership because that has to be, it has to be trusted. And I think the trust can only come from successful stories that then go back to the firehouse. You know, so-and-so was having a tough time and he almost lost his family, but he started counseling. Things are much better. And this is what's happening. Those things make it back to the kitchen table. And after a while, hey, you know, guy, this happened to him and you're sort of in the same position. What about you getting some help too? But if it goes through the job, I'll tell you right now, whether it's police, fire, anything else, would you want to go to your boss and say, I have problems in my family. I am blanking out. I have anxiety on a job like this.
Right.
No, you know, because now you're a risk. In New York City, a police officer that needs counseling, they take their gun away. So that affects their job immediately. So that's a deterrent to even asking for help. We had a horrible, horrible rash of suicides, police suicides in New York City. Actually, the past 3-4 years, it just spiked. And I do believe they rescinded that rule for that reason. And I don't know if it's still the case. And so I don't want to misspeak. But just that concept that there's going to be repercussions if you ask for help, negative repercussions, is going to prevent that person from asking for help.
Well, that's so the culture that we have to change, right?
Well, that's a culture that has to be changed.
Yes.
Do we have to change it? We have to give options, put it out there, and if they come, then that's great. But we cannot infiltrate and force upon anyone mm-hmm. change, especially first responders. There's a reason they are the way they are. I will not go into a burning building. If my kid is in there, maybe. Yeah, I would try.
If your kid was in the building, wouldn't you have been in the building with the kid?
Who knows? I mean, depends on their...
Well, my kids are 35 and 39. Oh, okay. So, you know, if it's my baby, I'm in there. But no, my point is that they do extraordinary jobs that most of us, I would say 99% of us, are not going to do. And so it comes with it, I think, a different mindset, right? Mm-hmm. They work hard at dangerous things. They play hard, sometimes at dangerous things. they put their own needs last. So there's a thing in the fire department where you call a mayday. It used to be in New York City, you call a mayday as a very last resort mm-hmm. because the people that are coming to save you are now going to be endangered, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're going to bring them in and endanger them, well, it's hard for me to say this without cursing, so I have to rephrase what I'm thinking. You're in a horrible situation. As a firefighter, you're there to protect. I would say that the old way of looking at it was, I'm not going to endanger my brothers mm-hmm. and sisters. I'm not going to do it. So I'm going to find a way out. And unfortunately, you lose firefighters that way. Now the mayday is call it a little sooner than you mm-hmm. might have other, you know, because we want to make sure everybody gets out alive. So they look at it a little bit differently. And this is not to say that they did it wrong for years. It's just, I know they're looking at it a little differently. There was a probie actually that called a mayday a few years back, and it was the smartest thing in the world that he ever did. He got out alive, and so did everybody else. So let's use that same thinking for mental health. That's you don't right. call a mayday when your spouse is gone mm-hmm. because they've had enough. You don't call a mayday when you're this close to pulling the trigger. You don't call a mayday when you do mess up because you show up at work and you're just not even there, and you didn't catch that kid that went into the closet where you would have done it before. So those kinds of things impact not just your life, but others. So the idea is call a little sooner, get the help so that it doesn't become a mayday.
And Nancy, that's perfect because Project Mayday is all about that. Let's shine a light. And we also have the Mayday movement that we're doing is let's talk about this exactly before those suicides happen. How many times do we need to see the example that what's currently happening in our society is not working? So providing these resources, Friends of Firefighters have been influential. Not only is New York Fire Department already respected, but now you have this organization that's making huge strides in mental health and preventative care, which is the key. And one other thing I want you to just highlight briefly is what types of resources do you offer? And these are all for free too, which is incredible.
It is incredible. And that's through a lot of our funders. And I know I was told if you name one, you're going to name all of them. So I really want to name all of them. I will say Gary Sinise Foundation. Gary is on our board. Gary's incredible. And his foundation does wonderful things as well. Steve Buscemi is on our board and he's very supportive. So we're very lucky to have people that have influence and they mm-hmm. can bring in other people. But we raise money every year to provide services for free to firefighters, active and retired, and their families. And we operate primarily out of an old firehouse that was decommissioned in 1960. And actually, I have to say, it wasn't decommissioned so much as it was sort of declared a disaster building, and they moved up the street, which is really important in New York, because if you're in a building where they disbanded the members, that's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the building then usually goes into the private hands, which this building did. We do pay rent. So we have to raise money every year to provide these services. We have other, prior to the pandemic, which we didn't even touch on and how much that crushed New York and everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at what my world is here. We had at one time 7 different locations. So we closed many of them because everything now is virtual, mm-hmm. which I kind of like, to be honest. But there are some firefighters that just absolutely love that platform. And it's HIPAA compliant. And it takes away the commute and all of that. But what it also takes away, which is unfortunate, is the familiarity of being in a firehouse. So especially for the retirees or the firefighter who might be active but doesn't want to bring their stuff into their own actual active firehouse, mm-hmm. they can go to this firehouse. And unfortunately, this past year, we lost two giants of our organization. Tony Catapano started Friends of Firefighters with me. He had over 42 years on the job, and he was my guide, period. He's the one that, Nance, make a laugh, Nance, don't do this. And I really learned from him. And the other is Billy Hodgins, and we lost both of them, unfortunately, both of them to 9/11 cancer. Oh. So when we reopen, it's going to be, my heart will be aching. But they had breakfast every month. And now Pete Colacion, who's retired and was very close to Tony and Billy, he's going to carry forth. He just had one, the first breakfast last week. So the idea is to bring them together in a familiar environment where they feel safe. The firefighter that comes in that we don't know that goes straight to the refrigerator, that's the point. Be at home. Go straight to the refrigerator and then chew me out because I don't have bottled water. Whatever it is, as long as they're feeling at home, mm-hmm. we've done something right. And they built it, so it's theirs. Mm-hmm. I get to work there, but they built it. It's theirs.
That's amazing. Wow. Like you said, we could go on and on, you know, with the pandemic and all that. So, but however, we are a little short on time. So we want to wrap things up here. And how we wrap them up, Nancy, is a little thing called rapid fire. You ready?
You look really excited. I can tell you are so excited.
Well, you know, I've been, I'm going to use a really stupid word. I've been victimized by rapid fire.
There's no victimization going on here. There's no victimization going on. So the rule is you have to answer in one word or one phrase. That is it. No on and on. Just Bree asks the question and you off the top of your head, let's see what you come up with. All right.
Isn't this what psychiatrists do when they're trying to plug somebody, like peg them for something? Go ahead. Yeah, I'm ready.
I'm going to follow your lead. I am not a counselor or a therapist.
We are not.
All right. Are you ready?
No, but go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for your honesty. First question. What's your favorite restaurant in New York?
I have to say Petit Crevette because my friend owns it and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Petit Crevette.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Number two. What would you sing at karaoke night?
Or what have you already sang at karaoke night?
I have never been so drunk as to do karaoke. Oh, wait. Yes, I was. So hold on 1 second. What would I sing at karaoke night? Well, the real funny thing is I actually was a singer for many years.
Oh, interesting.
Might be a next.
Turtle Blues.
Okay.
You have to look it up. I am not giving you the answer.
Okay.
Do you want to sing it right now?
No.
Okay. Number three, what was your very first job?
Shoveling coal in the coal room of PS-118. No, it wasn't PS-118. It was in Astoria School. I was, before that, I was pumping gas. I pumped gas at a gas station.
Oh, okay.
How old were you?
Yeah. 15 and then 16. Wow. I think I put in. And that was my day shift, and the night shift was at Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was really hard to get the grease out of my nails before I went to serve the donuts. That was difficult. But yeah, those were my first jobs.
Okay.
That was it.
Okay, number four. If you were stranded on a deserted island, what three things would you bring?
Things and not people?
Yes.
Yes. I guess a fireman calendar.
Matches. No, I have zero use for the fireman calendar. Zero. I would bring matches because I'm sensible. A knife. Oh my gosh, this is a really good question because you go automatically to luxury things, but let's get practical.
So matches, knife, and?
Needles and thread. I have to make myself some clothing.
Nancy, you're a survivor. Yeah. I'm into it. Okay. And last question. What is one word to describe yourself?
Oh, my God. That's a hard one.
Is it oh, my God?
That's a hard one. I try the best I can.
All right.
Trying. We did say a phrase. That's not one word, but we'll let it go.
Yeah. You,
okay,
yeah,
thanks. We'll
definitely let it go.
And your trying and your, you know, resilience absolutely exudes what, you know, your organization, Friends of Firefighters, that was you trying to help out. And look where it's got you, and look where it's got, you know, the city of New York. So, you are a leader through and through, and I would definitely follow you in any endeavor.
Oh, no. Just don't follow. Join.
Join. Right?
Don't follow
join.
Anybody. Join.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, we're in this together.
Absolutely. And, you know, Nancy, thank you so very much for coming on. And, you know, we have so much more to talk about that. We really, really hope you come back on. And we want to do something with you here in the future. And so that's something people can look forward to, is Project Mayday teaming up with Friends of Firefighters and making some things happen.
All right.
Wonderful.
Thank
I look
you,
forward
Nancy.
To it.
All right,
thank you.
So
and
much,
your
Nancy.
Questions were not scary. Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. All right, guys. This is Project Mayday. Call out.